Hi, everybody. I'm Paul Yeager. Welcome to another installment of the MTOM podcast, a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. We're back inside the studio this week as we pick up the electronic communication with Sarah Carden. She is a policy advocate with Farm Action. This is a nonprofit group, and we're going to get into what Farm Action is. One of the things that it is trying to put more farmers on the land, meaning more farmers, less larger farms. We're going to talk about some of the access points and some of the issues facing those who are trying to get into farming, like Sarah herself. We're going to find out how she ended up from the Northeast to Harvard to Georgia and now back to New York. And we'll see what her vegetable farm is doing and how they're trying to fit into this real-life agriculture food picture that's happening in real time. If you have any feedback for me, hit me up at paul.yeager@iowapbs.org. New episodes come out every Tuesday. We love to have you in the conversation. So if you have any guest ideas, send them my way. But now, let's get talking to Sarah. Sarah, we always love good rivalries. So as a Harvard grad, is this Harvard-Yale thing legit? I mean, we always hear about Alabama-Auburn. In my state, Iowa, Iowa State, I know it's not as big of a rivalry. Is it? It's not just athletics. Did you always feel a rivalry with Yale?
Man, that's not the question I was expecting. You can imagine people in a place like Harvard are not uncompetitive. So I think in general that, that people are always looking for a good way to measure how they're, going to be better than,
Right.
Boost their confidence. But
I mean, the world is always against it, I would imagine when you're one of the top institutions in the world ever, you always felt like everybody was coming after you.
You know, I was in my early 20s, I think you mostly are focused on, I don't think you really are aware of, or I wasn't aware of that yet. At the time I was focused on just enjoying. It was a really exciting opportunity to learn and to be in a really amazing place. And it's only later that it sort of dawned on me on that. And there's, I think I wasn't, as maybe involved in the Harvard-Yale rivalry as some others, but there were definitely some folks who felt very strongly about that.
How'd you end up there? You from the Northeast?
I grew up in the Northeast. Yeah, I had sort of a circuitous way about it, but my family was in the Northeast, and at the time I studied, so I sometime in my youth became really interested in animal communication. And I became really interested specifically in the evolution of language. And Harvard had an amazing program that was looking at language and the evolution of it relative to primates and looking for, within primates where what certain like structures in their communication were could have evolved into what we have, what we now have as language. And there weren't a lot of places doing that, as you can imagine. And so I dove in headfirst and I studied evolutionary biology and really focused on this language evolution and got pretty deep into that for a while.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Explain to me what evolutionary means. So it was more of the animal communication, primate communication. That's what I'm gathered.
That was my focus. So that my degree was in evolutionary biology. So it was much broader and just really about looking at the world and understanding it within the context of evolutionary pressures and specifically like biological processes. But then my thesis and what I really put a lot of my time went into was looking at language and how that evolved. And by the way I was approaching it was I was looking at various primates. So I studied lemurs, I studied chimpanzees kind of throughout this sort of web of ancestral DNA. And I tested for certain, I was testing and looking at certain linguistic mechanisms that build our language. So a really easy example is recursion. And so human language can embed almost like infinitely. We can just continue to embed these clauses. You know, the car that was parked around the corner with the broken windshield and the flat tire, and we can track this. And by the end of the sentence, we still realize we're talking about the car, but that's actually this very it's a complicated ability to be able to do that. And so I tested for things like that in primates to see, you know, much more basic, like if you put in a pattern. So one of the tests I ran was, you know, I literally chased lemurs around like a jungle in Madagascar with a boombox playing this AAB pattern. So it would be like boing, 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 and then like ch-ch-hoo, and various versions of this pattern. And then you're looking to see if when you change this pattern after you blasted at them for an hour, do they kind of go, huh? So if you change it to ABA, do they respond? Do they notice that? And then, you know, looking at lemurs to do that, and then looking at chimpanzees and seeing, well, lemurs can't do that, but chimpanzees can. So, you know, at some point in this evolution, that pattern came about.
Well, we could probably spend the next, I know we could spend a whole time about that. That is fascinating how understanding the way we react to things. So how do you make the transition from that world to an agriculture world?
Like I said, I had a very sort of indirect route, but I think, so I ended up in doing a lot of field research in college. You know, I took a year off. I was preparing to go to graduate school and continue to study that. But one of the things that I was grappling with is that I am very much I really respond well to being outdoors, being physical, being active participant. A lot of research is very observational based, and you know, as much as you love field work, eventually you have to go and sit down and do a lot of analyzation and writing. And I think I was in that time. I ended up just sort of by happenstance working on a couple different organic vegetable farms and responding really positively to that. And in doing that, I think I realized, I don't know if I realized it at the time or reflecting back, that what I was responding to was like a sense of satisfaction and gratification from the work. In addition to this real interactive nature, you know, instead of like excluding yourself from the system, you are part of the system as a farmer, and you are really trying to, you know, our production, what we try to do in our farm is make our production part of a larger living system of our environment that is, you know, going to be sustainable, that is, you know, not going to just be extractive, but that is contributing and just a more of a participatory member. And that's kind of where, you know, I just started farming and never really looked back, honestly. It just felt right.
But was it something, I mean, did you grow up on a farm?
No.
You know, so that's always the rare thing, is when someone doesn't grow up. It's one thing to wander away and not come back to the farm, but to not start on the farm and end up there, I'm always fascinated by that journey. So how?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely, gosh, I have so much envy of people who grew up on a farm, who have generational knowledge passed down to them, who have generational equipment, who have, you know, no, I didn't grow up on a farm. I did not grow up in a farming community. And my husband, who also, who I farm with, neither did he. And so we really had to come into this a little bit on our own, and it's challenging. Part of why we actually have moved to where we live now is to be in a real farming community. We have farmed in areas that are not real farming communities. And, you know, we really are looking for that support, that community support, the resources, and, you know, and it's, you know, it's fun to be an anecdote for a while, but
you feel like you're an anecdote a little bit, huh?
Not anymore, but you know, there was, you know, there was, I think when we were, you know, we've moved, this is the third time we have had, I mean, accessing farmland is just a tremendous hurdle, especially, you know, especially for a first generation farmer. And so this quest to be able to access enough land to really build a long sustainable operation has left, you know, we started our first farm in New Jersey. And then we ended up in the North Georgia mountains, and now we are up back in New York. And there's other factors. I mean, I'm not sure we had to make such large leaps. His family is in Georgia and my family is in the Northeast. So that's some of the bouncing.
Sure.
But also it's just been that we have had to continuously, we've had to compromise a little for what we can get by with at the time, knowing that we were, you know, that this was not going to be enough to hold us over indefinitely, and that we would have to kind of continue to hoard and build resources for the next step.
It's one thing to move from, you've mentioned, from region to region, maybe one side of the county to the other, or yeah, maybe 50 miles or 100 miles away. But when you make a move from the mountains of Georgia to Western New York, I mean, that's dramatically different climate, soil, crop, all where your markets are at, understanding all of those things for organic vegetables. I mean, what you're growing is different. So how do you translate any of the, maybe the crop's different, but how do you transition from dealing with your environment in those two different regions?
Great question. So I want to clarify, when in Georgia, we were at elevation. So it's not as it is. I mean, Western New York has substantially longer winters and shorter growing season. But we are actually growing the similar crops. It's just, you know, our timing has shifted somewhat. And there's other, you know, there's other shifts. I mean, we do a lot of research. My husband is like a spy, you know, he is a unofficial climatologist. I mean, he has a very, very understanding of weather patterns that I lean on, and we're leaning on now. But I mean, this is kind of also what I love about it, right? It's rebuilding and finding how you fit into this new environment. And, you know, part of, I think that I'm really, there's a lot of things about farming that I really am well suited to. I do also love like a little bit of adventure and I love to change it up. And so that, you know, trying to balance that with a career in farming has, you know, I think that is also part of explain some of our bigger moves. But that's also one of the reasons that I really like some of what Farm Action is advocating for, something that we have come up about, and I touched on this, is a lack of resources. We are not farming in a conventional manner by any means. I mean, I don't think we're breaking the model, but for as big of a market as organic, you know, produce has become, there really is just a huge lack of resources for people trying to implement these practices. And so we have really just adjusted to being our own, you know, having to really lean on ourselves in making these sort of adjustments and,
you already kind of started to take the road into Farm Action, because your movement is, to me, sounds very similar to what the organization is about. It is that access to land when you're fighting, and really it is a fight against much larger landowners for them to grab up an extra 400 acres or 200 acres or a 160 when it comes available, easier for them than, say, easier for someone to come into the inside. So what is it about First of all, tell me what Farm Action does and how it fits into your life. You kind of have already the second part, but let's explain the first part.
Yeah. So Farm Action is a research, policy, development, and advocacy nonprofit that is working to create a food and agriculture system that is going to work for everyone, not just a handful of powerful corporations. So you touched on that right there when you talked about, you know, we have been struggling to gain access to 40 acres of good tillable farmland. And that has been a huge lift for us. And we live in a world where, you know, the average farm size, depending on region, I don't know in Iowa, but I imagine it's around several hundred, close to 1,000 acres. And the truth is most of this farmland, you know, these large consolidated farms are not even really owned by, you know, most, there's a huge shift in farm ownership. That is, you know, they're owned by absentee corporate owners. You know, you see investments firms coming in and farmland rights are rising up. And so that is what, you know, Farm Action works on a lot of different issues, but our overall focus is to look at the broader consolidation that we see rampant throughout the farm and food system, and to advocate for a food and farm system that is not just going to continue to benefit corporations, but is going to benefit farmers and is going to benefit food system workers and farming communities in rural America, and really just all participants of the food system. Which is really everyone. So, you know, we use our own original research to guide this advocacy work and policy change. Just some like examples of what this looks like in everyday play could be, you know, we were thanked by the Biden administration for our help in drafting their playbook for competition that in the food system that has been coming up quite frequently now. We worked with Senator Booker to help him draft the Farm System Reform Act, which is a piece of legislation that we really support that's been introduced. We've published several reports on the food industry, and then we use these findings to help guide our policy recommendations. We focus most of our efforts, we're small, so we focus most of our efforts on federal policy, but we also manage a nationwide network of advocates for a more fair and just food system called our local leaders, and they really, we empower them to really lead our efforts on the state and local level. So, yeah, did that answer your question?
Yeah, that did. It did, and I just wanted to see if you answered, if there was one more part of that to jump off into this area. Do you find that the last 2 years have changed or accelerated the discussion when it comes to food production locally and differently than before when it comes to supply change? I mean, I've said it several times on this podcast, I've said it on the Market to Market show, that this the pandemic accelerated a lot of things that were happening. Do you think that the pandemic accelerated the way people care about where their food is grown, how long it spends on a truck before it ends up on their plate?
I don't know if the pandemic accelerated that. You know, somebody who has been tapping into that market for 15 years or so, I have seen that interest. It has been on a very healthy and upward steady pace, I think. But I do think what the, and maybe it did, but you know, that was already, I think that was already set in motion prior to the pandemic. What the pandemic really highlighted for a lot of people is, you know, we assume as Americans, we almost take our food security for granted. And I think it highlighted some real serious flaws in our food system. And people stopped feeling like they lost this sense of security that they would be able to always get what they want, you know, they'd be able to buy. It highlighted enormous issues of resiliency. You know, we continue even now to have these shortages. I mean, we have the infant formula shortage today. You know, a few weeks, you know, it just feels like every couple of months we have this new supply chain issue. And it's really easy, and corporation, you know, and people are really, these corporations are hiding behind the pandemic or the invasion of the Russian invasion of Ukraine or some other global issue that they, you know, is out of their hands. But what we see, if you look at their financial statements, while farmers are struggling, while consumers are paying record high prices, while food system workers are, I mean, during the pandemic, we saw, you know, you look at the meat packing plants, and food system workers were literally risking their life and you know, facing huge outbreaks. And meanwhile, these corporations are reporting record high profits. And so what we see is, you know, is really various forms of profiteering or profiteering, pandemic profiteering. And I think that the pandemic really is bringing that to light for, you know, I think that we have had a bit relatively stable last couple decades. The economy has, you know, generally been on the up, and people have felt somewhat secure as Americans. And what the pandemic did was really shake us at the surface of at our very core.
Well, I believe the term that you're trying to say is greedflation. That's how I've heard it described lately. Mm-hmm. So as someone who is, you're trying to live off of 40 acres, that is so different than a lot of the, I mean, agriculture has this picture painted in this country, maybe not so much globally. They think of the American farm, the family farm, and that's the way agriculture likes to portray the family farm. Now, there are large companies, there are large groups, the interest groups that are coming in to buy land. We have one of our market analysts, he moved out from Chicago to Iowa trying to find land. He goes, I got outbid by people from California that were coming in with outside money. I couldn't, he wants to do more of a traditional corn and soybean, you know, maybe some animal thing. Do you find that that is the case nationally, or is there a certain part of the United States that has more of a struggle of the fight for those acres? Do you feel that that acre battle is the same everywhere?
Oh, yes. I think that it depends. There's different pressures in different areas, but I mean, in our moves, we have, you know, when we moved here, we were considering a number of different areas before we came here, all around the country. Prices are through the roof, and really farm, like good prime farmland, it doesn't ever really even hit the market. I mean, it's really, you've got to be there and know somebody and have a, you know, not only connections, but a lot of luck, frankly, on your hand. There's huge, and this is, you know, I think there's a number of different issues at play. So, you know, in the area I'm in, you know, there's a lot, all farmers feel pressure for more land. Everybody seems to feel pressured for more land. And that's not so much because, it's not because farmers are greedy, it's because their margins are getting ever squeezed by, you know, both their buyers and their sellers, and they have very little buyer seller power. And so you need really to hit scale to carry your debt load, to make your payments, to make a living. So I think that, like, that is one contributing factor. And then, you know, you see in different areas, there's invest, you know, in real farmland communities, you are seeing a huge amount of investment, like your coworker is seeing, you know, investment firms, people from California. I mean, farmland is becoming, I mean, Bill Gates is the biggest farmland owner in the world, in the country. And then you have development pressure in, you know, less, you know, more peripheral farming communities. You know, one of the reasons we had to leave our farm in North Georgia was we needed more farmland, and we weren't going to be able to find that there because although we were 2 hours north of Atlanta, that was still, you know, there was expansion pressure coming into that community. And really most of the land there had been subdivided. Like, it just, there weren't even really large tracts left to be available. So, you know, it's a number of different pressures. But I think that, I think we hear this from farmers all over the country. And I never talk to a farmer who is not looking for more land.
Right.
I mean,
an extra 40, an extra 160, another 120 is going to help streamline a lot of my expenses. I'm going to be able to help pay for that tractor. Might not be new, but help cash flow that a lot better.
So, and that's this treadmill that we talk about a lot at Farm Action, is trying to help get these farmers off this treadmill of industrial production, which is really, I mean, you talked about, you know, your coworker's sort of corn soy rotation, which is a very typical rotation. Are all of our, you know, we're launching into right now, we're really focusing on our farm, our 2023 Farm Bill campaign. In the past, all of these policies within the Farm Bill have really propped up these models of industrial production. It makes it hard not to be a corn soy grower. You have all of the price support programs. You have all of, you know, crop insurance is really written to support these kinds of operations. And this isn't just like by accident, and it's not to feed, you know, we have this sort of false narrative that this is to feed, you know, America has to feed the world. But what we are feeding is not the world. Most of the majority of these grains are going into turning into animal feed in industrial operations of confined, you know, CAFOs, of confined animal feeding operations. And these meat exports are being, I'm sorry, I have a cat.
You can have the cat. It's fine. Yeah.
But these meat exports are going not to hungry nations, but to nations that have, you know, developing middle classes that can afford to pay global meat market prices. And you can basically trace a direct path of the taxpayer subsidy dollar into the pockets of these CEOs of meatpacking corporations. And they have really been exerting a lot of influence, and they spend a tremendous amount of lobbying dollars to ensure that this path is kept safe and continues to be protected through the legislation such as the Farm Bill. And so, you know, one of our big focuses is really looking at this 2023 Farm Bill and the 2028 Farm Bill, and looking beyond that to shift this, and because the Farm Bill is, I want to take a step back for a second, is really an incredibly important piece of legislation that comes up every 5 years. And, you know, people, you may hear about it and they think it's kind of just for farmers, but it shapes the structure of our whole food system. And so that is a really important, powerful place to start to shape change in this food system and to try to create, to lay the groundwork for policies that, instead of supporting and propping up these industrial models, will support smaller, mid-sized farming operations that and enable them to be able to step off this treadmill of continuous expansion and conventional farming methods of growing feed for animals that are sent abroad and raised in very, you know, confined situations, and instead to shift those funds towards, to allow farmers to have support to grow food for their communities and to support and put some of this money back into their communities. And it all, you know, it ties back into farming communities too. We see this industrial model takes all of the wealth and resources and extracts them out of these farming communities and leaves our rural America hollowed. And, you know, that we have rural Americans face higher poverty rates. They face higher food insecurity rates. They don't have access to healthcare in many places. You know, I mean, we're still trying to get internet to rural America. And, you know, the more traditional, or not more traditional, but the farm model that we are really trying to support is one that is going to enable farmers to grow food so that we can import less and be more resilient and not be so susceptible to these global issues shattering our food supply chain. And that it also has the added benefit of keeping that that money in your communities. If you have farmers who can buy their supplies from a local independent farm supply store and then bank at a local bank and support, you know, their taxes go into local community uptake instead of this industrial model where, you know, you look at large corporations, they're bringing in most of their inputs elsewhere, not from the local community. They're pushing out independent farm supply and other support supporters, independent equipment operators. And so there's the wealth and their sales is none of it stays in the community.
Well, and it is back to some of the things that you've mentioned throughout our conversation here is it is about streamlining equipment sales. If I have one regional dealer, that's cheaper for me as a big manufacturer of equipment to have the same as opposed to competition from the green tractor to the red tractor behind me here. But I mean, we know that is how those models have set up. John Deere has absolutely done that with their equipment dealerships, just like Feed has done the same thing. But rural America was populated on the farm throughout the years, whether it's Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, it was the family that had plenty of kids that worked and there were workers around. The hired man or the hired woman was down the road and she helped. But again, we've made agriculture with the corn and the soybeans and the wheat and the large commodity crops. We've been more efficient. We don't need as many people. Are you telling me that how do we get back to that more of a let's take care of our own track of land in our own county and community, and maybe not feeding the people of name the country where our product goes, Japan, China, Brazil, where whoever takes our exports. I mean, it's a global economy now, but it sounds like we need to be thinking more of a local economy.
Absolutely. And we really are, you know, it's, you know, this concept of efficiency, you know, is one of these, you know, we have a report, we call it the Truth Report. And in this report, we highlight these myths that big ag has continued to propagate in order to, and they spend a lot of money pushing these myths out, and that really helps prop up these systems are failing. You talk about it being more efficient, but how is it more efficient? We have higher, you know, our food prices are higher than they've ever been before. We have tremendous rates. I think I read in rural America, like 23%, a recent report came out that something like 23% of rural Americans are food insecure and make 14% in urban areas. It's not, you know, I mean,
it's not the same. Great.
It's not the same, but also 14% is too high. There's a limit to the scales of efficiency. Then, you know, I think that we, you know, that was reached in, you know, decades ago. And at this point it has shifted from that to, you know, greedflation, as you so-called have put it. And it's not benefiting the system as it is not really benefiting anybody but these corporations. So you brought up this great example of, you know, the equipment dealers. It's beyond only just access to one equipment dealer or something, but so one of our campaigns is what we call the right to repair. They have been original equipment dealer manufacturers have been restricting. So it looks like you're familiar.
I'm familiar with right to repair. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So they have been, restricting access, to farmers and to independent repair shops' ability to repair equipment. You know, this is when farmers, you know, I don't want to go into this if you're already, you know.
Audience is familiar with right to repair. We are. I think of my father. He didn't trade up to get new equipment towards the end of his farming career because he still knew how to fix the 1970s version of his tractor, whereas neighbors, we have the 90s and the 2000s. No, he couldn't fix that. It's not that he wouldn't have learned how to. It was just much harder to do. It was a simpler machine, and it didn't have all that computer software. But I know people are probably listening to this while driving through the field right now on auto steer. It is, you know, it is allowed and real data that comes in, and we can analyze a cornfield to see where something needs to go or the seed is not going in on the row here. We know some of that stuff in real time. We could discuss that all day. I want to finish up with your operation real fast here. Sarah, as you look in your area, how many people, we'll just say in your county or 50-mile radius of where your farm is, your 40 acres of organic vegetables, how many people are like you in that area?
Not very few. I'm trying to think of, you know, I don't know, you know, I know of one other operation that has a similar model that we do. However, we moved, I want to note that we moved to this area because it's unique. It is a thriving rural community, partially because it has a very strong Mennonite community. And they have, you know, I don't want to speak to on behalf of Mennonites, but they have pushed against this industrial model. And they, you know, my area is full of vibrant mid-size farms that are diverse, that, you know, have a dairy, a dairy, grass-fed dairy component. And, you know, they really are full, vibrant homesteads. You know, they have large kitchen gardens and one of the, I think, reasons that, and they're very successful. I mean, one of the reasons it's hard to find farmland here is because the Mennonites will buy it up very quickly.
And I don't know the Mennonite difference between the Amish difference. I have more Amish in my background of understanding their setup. Mm-hmm. The Amish in my area in Iowa have always been organic. Have the Mennonites been that same way?
No, I don't think they're all organic. And the Mennonites use tractors. The Amish where I in here, they are mostly draft power still. But they have closed loop circuits. The money that comes, they put no money outside of their communities. They, you know, they might sell some things outside of their communities, but that is actually kept them very vibrant. And, you know, I'm not saying that we need to close ourselves off from the world. That's not possible or realistic on a nationwide scale. But I think there's something to learn from that, unlike many areas. And, you know, when I look beyond my surrounding counties, not very far, where there aren't as, you know, you see a much, I think you probably see a much, when you get outside of my county and a couple other counties, you see a much more traditional scape of, we have kind of a combination of grain producers, larger scale grain producers, and some larger scale dairy operations. And you also see a shift in community. You see, you know, you see a little bit less vibrant community support, I would say.
Who do you think will be your target audience then for some of your product?
Or we live close enough. Yeah. You know, we're about an hour south of Rochester. There's a number of large, we have sort of a three-way revenue stream. We operate a CSA, as well as we do, some wholesale, and, we do some other direct marketing. But we are part of this move is to shift out of the retail aspect and just do the CSA and work with some aggregators on the wholesale end. So we're partnering with some aggregators in the Rochester area, and the CSA. There's a couple of pretty they're larger. They call them cities. I don't think I would call them a city. As my 6-year-old son says, there's no tall buildings.
Yeah, it's not Boston. So, yeah, that's not Copley Square or anything like that.
But, you know, more populated towns around us. The Finger Lakes is a little funny because you really have to go north and south. You can't go east and west because you have to go, there's all these lakes kind of in between that you'd have to go around to get to. So the larger communities tend to be at the tops and bottoms of the lakes.
I better tie in with your boss here real fast on you are a policy advocate for Farm Action. So advocate for one. Give me one or two policies that you really want to see in that next farm bill from this organization, and what's something that we should watch?
That's great. So we want to see one or two. Let me think of it. One, we want to see a cap on some you stumped me there for a second.
I wasn't even thinking about talking about the farm bill with you, but yeah, when you open up the door like that, and you've mentioned a couple of things already, but access, I would imagine, sounds like a high priority. I don't know how you accomplish that though.
Yeah. So, well, oh, land access is that? So land access is not necessary. It is a high priority. It's not the focus of Farm Action. We want to see a cap on risk payments, and so that there's one of our top priorities is to really keep these large corporations from kind of funneling the bulk of these support payments away, because one of our approaches to this, we're trying not to advocate for more spending so much as shift the available funds around. Another top priority we're really looking for is we're trying to tie our conservation payments to risk and to some of the crop insurance and disaster relief. And so there's a new pandemic program that was the cover crop. It gives a $5 discount to crop insurance for farmers who are using cover crops. We would like to see that program permanently funded and expanded to be able to reach more and to increase that payment to at least $10 per acre or something a little bit more substantial to help further incentivize.
Well, and I've seen that. And boy, you want to talk about a hard sale in some areas, it is the cover crop. But sometimes an incentive like that starts to get the attention of a producer going, well, you know, just maybe I should do that. So we'll see how that one works out. Anything else?
That ties into some of our push for more technical and research development. I mean, there's a lot of good reasons to cover crop for the farmer. You know, I mean, it has a huge amount of benefits. And so, you know, trying to get that outreach out there to all of the farmers is another component of expanding that.
It's always something. I look forward to talking to you again, because I want to hear how things are going in your region after you settle in and get a full growing season and see how things shake out as you try to balance the two. It's always fun to meet people like you, Sarah. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you very much for listening and watching this installment of the MTOM podcast. I'm Paul Yeager. Thank you for watching. We'll talk to you next time.